Good morning. You are listening to NPR News. I'm Ewan Kerr, sitting in for Kerry Miller. Some 100,000 people are expected to see Martin Luther, Art and the Reformation before its run at the Minneapolis Institute of Art ends in mid-January. As Lutherans around the world know, 2017 is the 500th anniversary of the publication of Luther's theses denouncing the sale of indulgences, an act which launched a revolution within Christianity and changed history. The show at the Institute contains no fewer than 250 objects. There's artwork, religious objects, many artifacts from Luther's own life, and a huge collection of books, pamphlets, and other printed material, which at the time were vital to spread Luther's message. There's even a plague doctor's hood representing the threat of sudden death, which hung over everyone at the time. If you've already seen the show, we'd love to hear your impressions. What pieces grabbed you? What gave you a new understanding of history or how we see things today? Give us a call at 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828, or you can go to our blog at nprnews.org/live, or perhaps you have a question for our guest, Tom Rasher. Tom is the John E. Andrus III Curator of Prints and Drawings at the Minneapolis Institute of Art. He's also the curator of the Martin Luther Show. Welcome. Thanks for coming in today.
Thank you, Ewan. It's a pleasure to be here.
This is a unique show made possible by a unique set of circumstances in Germany right now. Can tell us about that.
Ewan, we have a very narrow window of opportunity to have this exhibition because our colleagues in Germany are expecting tremendous numbers of visitors next year for the 500th anniversary of the posting of Luther's 95 Theses. As a result, they are anticipating, because of the crowds they're anticipating, they're cleaning up. They're painting their galleries. They're sprucing up so that they'll look their best. As a result, the objects that are normally in their care are available to us. They've been taking them off view, and so we have this short time in which the objects can come to us. But this view, this window of opportunity is very, very narrow. It's so short that this exhibition is actually more brief than a normal MIA exhibition. We're going about 11 weeks instead of our usual 13. And this show will not travel. It's not going to any other museum, and it won't be reconstituted back in Germany. It's just this little opportunity for really a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to bring these objects together.
You have probably been hearing from people all over the U.S. wanting to come and see this.
Absolutely.
I mean, what's it been like?
It's been great. It's so gratifying to see people caring so much about an exhibition and going to great lengths to come. We've had people come, as you say, from all over the country. Even the first day of the show, a man came up to me and said he'd driven up from Nashville, and another woman told me that she had come from Portland, Oregon, and she'd been there for 3 days. So there are people who are very interested in it. I receive calls from people who can't come to the show and who still want to know about it. And it turns out that it's very, very important to people.
I'd like to ask you to kind of set the scene for us. I mean, what must it have been like to live 500 years ago in Luther's time and to witness the changes that he brought about? I mean, it was a complicated time.
Yeah, I think it was perplexing. I think that people were facing new ideas that they were unprepared for, and their traditions were being undermined. Their assumptions were no longer valid. You had rulers who had subjects who were fighting among one another, and they couldn't understand this because everybody had gotten along just fine before. You had people who were trying to figure out what things meant to them anymore. For instance, art is a central theme in this exhibition. And you had people who wondered whether there was validity to art anymore or what art should look like to accommodate the new ideas. And you see many different reactions to that in this exhibition. You have some people who destroyed art. And so we have examples of medieval sculpture that's been toppled, or you had a desire to illustrate the Word of God. And so one of Luther's central tenets is that the way you knew God's word was to read the Bible. And so people came up with paintings that literally illustrated the Bible, word by word, virtually. And in some cases, this can be truly magnificent. In other cases, it comes out a little wonky to our eyes. And so the works of art that are in the show are sometimes beautiful, sometimes strange, sometimes weaponized, but always interesting.
You also have artifacts from Luther's home, and you, I was lucky enough to take a tour with you around the show just before it opened, and you showed me a piece of, I don't know what it would be, ash.
Oh, it was industrial waste.
Industrial waste.
Slag.
And yeah, and this is an amazing story.
Yeah, I mean, asking what it's like to live in this world. Okay, yeah. A very physical manifestation of it was that when Luther grew up, he grew up in a mining town. He said his father was a poor miner and his mother carried the firewood on her back. It was kind of an I was born in a log cabin sort of a story. But to imagine that scene, that what you saw was as I say, industrial waste, copper slag. This was a copper mining region. And as a result, it was an industrial area. It wasn't like what we think of with illuminated manuscripts when we look back and we see pictures of people tending their flocks and harvesting their grain. No, this was really hardcore industrialization. And so much so that the hills around Mansfeld, the town where Luther grew up, were deforested. Everything had been, all the wood had been chopped down. Wood was very, very valuable and expensive. If you used it, you didn't use it for your cooking water at home or your cleaning water. It was for firing smelting furnaces and for building mines, this kind of thing. So when it came time to cook your dinner, what you did is you took a sturdy pail and you went down to the copper smelting furnace and you picked up a bucket full of glowing hot slag and took it home and dumped it directly into your cooking water. I mean,
not underneath the pot. You put it into
the
water.
They preferred the slag to stones because stones would explode if they put hot stones in there. But the slag did fine. And but it gives you a sense of a little bit of hell on earth. I mean, you could stand in the center of this town and look up, see these hills with erosion and tree stumps sticking up, and you'd have the belching smoke and the stench of these furnaces. And you'd have people burrowing their way into these mountains. These mining tunnels were only about 16 inches high. Imagine going down into the earth in circumstances like that with your wearing a little leather hood and you have your tiny short pickaxe because you can't even swing a long one, and you're burrowing into the ground and trying to get this material out. It was a very difficult life.
So life was very, very tough, and the church was very, very important. And Luther went to study. He became an academic studying.
Yeah. What happened was that Luther's log cabin story was not actually accurate. It turned out that his family was quite rich, and his father had a great big house. He had mining interests and all this. So he had enough money to send Luther to Latin school locally, and then eventually Luther went to boarding school in the university. And his father wanted him to become a lawyer to serve the family business. But Luther had other ideas. And one day, as he reports, there was a big storm. And Luther was so scared that he prayed to Saint Anne, the patron saint of miners. And he said, "Help me, Saint Anne. If I survive this, I'll become a monk." And so he survived, and true to his word, he became a monk. So Luther was very interested in the religious world, and this religious world that Luther was interested in was a stark contrast to that mining world, to that awful world of going down to the mines. You know, on a Sunday or any day, a miner could go to the church and cross the threshold, and suddenly it got a little taste of heaven. You'd be in a big room with high ceilings, and there might even be colored light in the room from stained glass windows, and there you'd see paintings that were colorful and maybe even gilded. So you'd see saints and angels, sculptures and paintings that were otherworldly, that gave you a sense of something to hope for in the afterlife. And this was very intriguing to Luther, although he thought he'd never get there. He thought he was going to go to hell. He was so concerned with the fate of his soul that he was mortified. He thought, how can I live up to the Ten Commandments? For instance, none of us can. And he took it so seriously that his confessor, the head of the monastery, said, "You know, Luther, lighten up a little bit, buddy. You're really taking this to the extreme." But Luther was a guy who took things to extremes, as we know in retrospect, because He had firm ideas, and he took them to their logical conclusions, which was often quite radical. As a monk and a priest, he thought he was going to hell. But when he thought, wait a minute, in the end, we have a loving God. He's not going to do this to us. He gives us the gift of salvation, and so we can eventually go to heaven. And then he came up with a radical theology that simply said that if you ask God for forgiveness, he will forgive you. And so it was night and day from what had come before. So Luther took off in a whole new direction, and his words were so compelling to so many people that it created a groundswell, virtually a revolution. This caused changes in society, caused changes in art, as we see, changes in thought. Some of them were positive, some of them were negative.
I'd like to just put out the number again. Our guest this morning is Minneapolis Institute of Art curator Tom Rascher. He is one of the organizers behind Luther, Art and the Reformation, which runs through mid-January. If you have a question or a comment for him, give us a call, 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. You can also go to our blog at nprnews.org/live and leave a comment there. There is this story, perhaps apocryphal, that he one day nailed his 95 Theses to the door of the Wittenberg Church.
Yeah, we have no idea.
We don't actually know. But he did actually have, I mean, these were not entirely new ideas, but he had the advantage of the press.
Yes.
Which was a relatively new innovation at the time.
Yeah, actually, people talk about it being so new. It wasn't all that new. It was already 65 years old. And if we think about our own time, computers are about 65 years old. And so, but they continue to change our lives on a daily basis. And the same thing was going on at the printing press. And it just so happens that the Reformation, Martin Luther's 95 Theses, were one of the first focal point moments where suddenly people cared about something. Everybody cared about something. So when Luther posted his 95 Theses in whatever form he did, we don't know if he nailed them to the church door. People became interested in these incendiary words that he'd written. And so as an entrepreneurial venture, printers took his words and they set them into type and they printed them and they started to sell. And so other printers saw that, so they copied them and they started to print them up. And so for the first time, information goes viral. And you said Luther had the advantage of the printing press. Well, was it an advantage or was it not? Because he suddenly couldn't control his words anymore. They were out there. As I said, the information went viral. Neither Luther nor the Pope could control the words. In the old days, the Pope could probably come in and shut down an operation that was sending out information. But by Luther's time, you couldn't do it anymore. And so his words are out. He's in danger because the words are incendiary, so he has to kind of fight for his life, and he has to ride the wave of his newfound fame.
Of course, this launched centuries of conflict within the various elements of Christianity within Europe, and the wars. There was people having to go into hiding, and you capture a lot of that in the show.
When you talk about the fractious nature of it, there's actually a wonderful anti-Luther Catholic satire in the show called the Luther Sprouting Heretics. It's a tree with many different branches, and the idea is that there's so many different ideas about how to conduct one's religion that everybody starts disagreeing with each other to the point where everything is intractable. And in this show, we really do deal with the conflict. As I said, this was a focal point moment for the printing press. Printing presses don't only print words; they also print images. And this was the birth of modern political cartooning. We see satires that are done by both sides, both attacking the Pope and attacking Luther, and some of them are really abusing. Some of them are fairly crude, and some of them still have the power.
Crude is a mild word for the ones which I saw.
The sides were attacking each other, But sometimes the sword was mightier than the pen, and so there were battles that broke out, and we cover that in the show. We have some incredible pieces of armor, two helmets. One belonged to Charles V, the most powerful secular figure in all of Europe at the time, an amazing object. And Charles wound up at war with Protestant dukes, and so we go into these battles and the intrigue that took place. The Protestants were outmanned and outgunned, and so they had to use their wits. And there's an amazing story in the show of a woman who's Duchess Elizabeth of Roclitz. She was the only woman in the Federation of Dukes, the Protestant Federation of Dukes, and she really did use her cunning and her wit. She formed a spy ring. And she developed her own code, and she developed a network of spies who were dressed as laborers, as carpenters and butchers and this kind of thing. They could travel around pretty much unnoticed, incognito. And they were observing what was going on, and they'd send messages back, or they'd go directly back to Elizabeth, and she'd write out what they said in a secret code that she developed herself. And we have one of these letters in the show. It's hard to read because it is in code, but it's about the imperial supply lines and the troop movements. And she sent this thing off to the leader of the Protestant troops, a guy named John Frederick, who is the Duke of Saxony, and so he could stay one step ahead of the imperial forces. But one day, as the troops of Charles V, the imperial troops, were coming closer to castle, her husband said, "We got to get out of here. We got to move to another castle." And suddenly, the spy ring is broken. She no longer has access to this information. And it literally, in a matter of days, the imperial troops take the Protestant troops by surprise. They capture, they wound the leader, John Frederick, and they send him off to jail. And this results in him being stripped of his titles and being stripped of much of his land. And so this is a huge blow to the Protestants. But nonetheless, it's fascinating to see the role that women take in the show, for instance. Here we have this Elizabeth Roclitz, who was really saving the day as long as she could. And we have the introduction of education for women. Previously, women were not normally sent to school, but Luther felt that the word of God is represented in the Bible, so he translates the Bible into German so people could read it, and then he educates people so they could read it. And this was the first time that women were welcomed into schools that gave you a classical education that really formed full literacy. And there's at the end of the show, there's a remarkable document which also indicates Luther's attitude toward women, and it's his last will and testament. It's it's very unconventional, because Luther decided that he was going to go against all trends in the disposition of property. Normally, a widow would receive the wedding gifts and a few household objects, but really the wealth of the family would be distributed among the sons, the house, the jewels, the treasure, this kind of stuff. And Luther said, no, that's not right. He said, my wife is really the one who organized the whole operation. Luther didn't really care about money. Katie, his wife, wore the pants of the family. He had called her Hair Katie. And she was running the house, a boarding house. She organized the farms that they owned, and she ran a brewery. And he said, really, she's the one who knows how to operate this. She should have it all. So he wrote a will that included a love letter to her and gave her everything. And this was so odd that he had to register this with the Duke, with other Protestant luminaries, and eventually his wishes were fulfilled. And in a sense, it sets a pattern for the way our lives work today, where we tend to think if we die, our spouse should have everything that we can give him or her, to give the survivor. And so there's another unconventional thought that Luther had about the relationship of men and women, and he started a practice that we live today.
We have a number of people on the line, and first of all, we have Tom, who is calling in from Hopkins. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning. I just wanted to share a little story about a week that I spent at St. Olaf College down in Northfield. It took about 25, 30 years ago. An author had released a new biography of Luther, and so they were doing a whole long seminar on that. And during the week, the campus came under several major thunderstorms, with lightning strikes hitting everywhere near us. And it was just so fitting, and it made such a great period of discovering more about Luther and, of course, his own lightning strike moment.
Wow.
Well, yeah.
Did you consider becoming a monk?
Absolutely not. I think the discussion did come up several times with the leadership, and it was pretty funny. And it was also kind of, startling to have that kind of moment happen.
It really brings it alive, doesn't it?
Yeah. Thanks very much for calling in, Tom. We also have Daniel from Thief River Falls. Good morning, Daniel.
Yeah, good morning. I very much appreciate the exhibit. I went there actually on Black Friday, day after Thanksgiving. So instead of shopping, I enjoyed the art. Beautiful.
Thank you.
Yeah, I just want to add a fine point to the theology, which is, of course, something we could debate hour after hour. But, you know, you talked about, you know, asking for forgiveness, you receive forgiveness. Well, you know, the foundation stone really for Luther, I think, is God's grace, that without any merit, without any worthiness at all, he chooses a sinner such as me,
yes,
and such as you, and gives to you the gift of salvation. So that, you know, the role of the church and the role of the believer is simply to celebrate this over and over, and then also to announce it to other people, which I think Luther's educational reforms were to make every person a preacher in a way. So,
correct. Well,
any thoughts how you want to express that? Or
sure. We show that in the exhibition, I think, by in several ways. For instance, we have a robe there, which is an Augustinian monk's habit from the 16th century, and since the 18th century, it's been Luther's habit. We don't really know if it belonged to him, but it's important because it shows people's desire for tangible connection to their faith. Because even if it may well be Luther's habit, but if it's not, it needed to be created. But another reason I like to have it there is that Luther chose to dress modestly throughout the rest of his life. Even when he became a major public figure and a powerful man, he dressed in this humble in humble clothing, drab in color, and the idea was that we're all beggars before God, and we only receive God's grace because he gives it to us. We can't earn it. And so I think that's, as you said, that's a central tenet of his theology, and it was represented very much in the way he dressed.
We have Tom Rasher in the studio today. He's the curator of the Minneapolis Institute of Art show, Martin Luther, Art and the Reformation. We got a call from Gloria in Minneapolis who wanted to know about the lectures which are being done alongside the show. She missed the first two, apparently, and is wondering if there's going to be a chance to hear them in some form.
We have had a very nice series of lectures with Dr. Harold Meller from the State Museum of Prehistory in Halle, speaking about Luther archaeology, and I spoke about the creation of the show overall, and we had another expert come in, Armand Kunz, to speak about Lucas Cranach as an artist. I believe that these are available on Vimeo. I am not a terribly tech-savvy guy. I sort of left off in the 16th century with Luther, I think. But these have been recorded, and I believe they are available online. There may be links on our website. I honestly just can't tell you right now, but I believe there are.
This show has clearly attracted a lot of attention, and you cover the good and the bad of Luther's life. I mean, you don't pull some of the punches about some of his writings, which have been seen as antagonistic.
Yeah.
We're actually running out of time here, so we probably can't go into that in any great depth. But what do you hope the legacy of this exhibit will be?
I think there are a number of things I'd like to see come out of it. One is an awareness of this era, and a realization that Luther affects us all, regardless of our faith, and that this was a time of real sentient beings who were trying again, who had new ideas and were expressing them in new ways, and everybody had to deal with them. And so they face problems just like we do today. And from, I have a friend who's got a bumper sticker that says, "Not all the interesting people are still alive." And it really is a case of that you can go back and witness history and learn from it. I also hope that it'll expand people's curiosity, maybe even a desire to go see these places where the objects came from, if one can. But in any case, to learn about them. I actually thought that the Luther era might turn out to be a little bit dreary when I started off on this project, and I've come to find it fascinating and vibrant. And it's just another instance of art opening my eyes to new horizons.
You are selling time-specific tickets. People come in at a certain time.
Yeah.
You've had to expand your opening hours because people are spending so much time in there.
The show is up on a Monday now.
Yeah. Is there a chance, do you think, that this may sell out, that people aren't going to be able to get tickets if they don't get in soon?
Well, I think over the holidays, the traffic might be very heavy. And, of course, with all of our shows, people have waited to the last minute. And so the last few days really become quite crowded. But if you call in and you can reserve ahead, and right now with the Monday openings being new, not everybody's aware of it, and so that's the traffic's a little lighter. It's a great time to go to the show, but I do urge people to call in advance, and maybe even you can buy tickets online too. But if you go on Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday, it's going to be a little lighter than it will be on Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, and so you won't be subject to quite the same crowds.
Tom Rasher is curator of Martin Luther, Art and the Reformation, which runs through mid-January at the Minneapolis Institute of Art. Thanks very much for coming in today.
Ewan, thanks for inviting me.